Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Greetings and welcome to this next iCoder podcast. I'm Ian McDuff and I'm your host for the series, and I'm speaking with you from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleague and fellow member of the global ODR community, Professor David Larson. Hello, David. David is Professor of Law at the Mitchell Hamline School of Law and Senior Fellow at the Dispute Resolution Institute. He's been involved with online dispute resolution, ODR, hereafter, since 1999, and is the system designer helping create an ODR platform for the New York State Unified Court System, to which I think we'll return. David is the John H. Farrisey Chair, Junior Chair for Empirical Studies, and a fellow of the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution and the American Bar Foundation. He's 60 legal publications and made more than 170 professional presentations in 10 different countries. He's past chair of the American Bar Association section of dispute resolution, co-chair of the section's ODR Standards Task Force, and was a member of the ABA e-commerce and ADR Task Force. He teaches arbitration law, arbitration skills, disability law, employment discrimination law, online dispute resolution for the 21st century, labor law and torts. Is there anyone else on the faculty, David?
Some days it does not seem like it.
That's extraordinary. It's a heck of a load. I'm surprised that you're not doing sort of introductory law courses there and probably a bit of family law as well. But, well, that's a big load. As a now ex-academic, I think that's absolutely terrifying load. David worked at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission Office of the General Counsel Appellate Division in Washington, D.C., and on behalf of that office, participated in drafting the regulations and interpretive guidance for Americans with Disabilities Act. He was founder and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Alternative Dispute Resolution and Employment, an arbitrator for the Omaha Tribe and other disputes, and a hearing examiner for the Nebraska Equal Opportunity Commission. David, what I'm going to do also is I will ask Colin when he edits this to put a link to your university bio so that people can see what you're up to, because there's a lot of really important work you're doing. So, David, thank you in what is obviously a very busy schedule for taking time for this conversation. It's very good to see you. Very good to talk with you. So welcome to this podcast. Good to see you.
Yeah, thank you again for the invitation.
Yeah, great. I think you came to Auckland to the ODR Forum in 2018, didn't you? I recall.
Unfortunately, I did not.
You did not? So I saw you the previous year in Paris.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Super. So David, there's a few questions come up and things that are important to you, but going back to one of the items mentioned in your bio, the New York State Unified Court System on the ODR project, can you tell us something about that project and what you were doing? What's going on there?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a long story. Started back in October 2016, and the American Bar Association, and I'm an officer in that association, had some grants to support access to justice. And we made a proposal that we thought online dispute resolution could be a way that we can increase access to justice. And we were awarded $60,000, it's kind of seed money, to then delegate to some or assign to some entity that was working on ODR in New York State. It was just entering the conversation and exploring the idea of online dispute resolution. So on behalf of the ABA, I was assigned to the New York State Unified Court System as their liaison to explore a pilot project using online dispute resolution. So I went to the first meeting, and they had pretty much decided that they were going to work on credit card debt collection cases, because that's a crisis in New York. Mm-hmm. And 94% of the cases are default judgments. Nobody's going to court. Nobody's showing up. We're not sure why. Maybe it's just because they're not getting service. Maybe there's sewer service. People are saying they did served it and they didn't. There's a lot of problems going to court in Manhattan, getting there, parking, childcare, vacation time. People just weren't showing up for court. Intimidation, fear, variety of reasons. So the thought was, well, if we started an online dispute resolution platform for credit card debt collection cases, maybe we can increase that participation and access to justice for the debtors. So I went to the first meeting. They said they kind of explained the problem and why they thought they would use online dispute resolution. And I said, don't start with that. That's a bad idea. It's too complicated. It's too heavily regulated. It's why don't you try small claims? And they had decided that, no, it's a crisis, and we're going to use online dispute resolution to resolve that crisis. And so there it was. And the problem with using online dispute resolution platform for credit card debt collection is that it's extremely heavily regulated at the federal level, at the state level, at the county level, and at the city level. And people that were involved in those concerns wanted to make certain that all the protections that exist at every one of those levels would be built into the ODR system, which, as you know, it would be difficult to do.
Right.
So we tried to design this extremely convoluted system where we tried to capture every due process protection that's available to credit card debt holders, and it got very complicated. And but we worked on it. We finished a comprehensive program. We had talked to everybody we thought we could talk to. And at the 11th hour, we met with a legal services group in New York City. The Claro organization set up, you can't possibly do this. You can't put debtors in virtual spaces with creditors. And they will just take advantage of them consistently. And one of the problems was that New York was not developing its own ODR platform. They were contracting out. So they're going to put out a request for proposals. And the feeling was, if we show our full detailed platform to somebody, we're going to compromise that request for proposals process. It'll taint it, because that means somebody got it early, somebody got a good look at it. They don't know, we won't know who they gave it to, and maybe that whole process will be undermined. So the judgment by New York was that we can't really give the whole platform to the critics, because we don't know where it's going to go, and we have to make sure that we're even-handed. So they never saw the entire platform and all the hyperlinks we had to legal services, all the off-ramps we had, and they said that they can't do this. And then they put on a campaign to contact the mayor, and governor, everybody could think of, state legislators. Got to stop this. People in the judicial system. And they stopped it. They were able to stop it. New York was too concerned. They said, well, if there's this much dissent, we can't go forward with it. So then we had to kind of retract and start over with small claims. And that was kind of a long talk there, so I'll stop for a minute. But anyway, that's how I first got involved on credit card debt collection, which, after working at it for a couple of years, was never implemented. But then we pivoted and turned to small claims.
This. So much to unpack there, isn't there, David? And particularly, I think one of the consistent threads through all these conversations that I've had with our colleagues has been the access to justice driver, and that's behind your comments. But no one has mentioned as clearly as you have the importance of having all the protections built in, all the protections that are important for due process and the rule of law. Can't be bypassed when you're doing ODR work. Was that the same when you moved to the small claims issues?
Well, as you can imagine, small claims is not as heavily regulated. So right off the bat, that was going to be a little easier to deal with. But mm-hmm. Have that being said, there still are a lot of concerns. And one thing we did was we decided to put in it's ostensibly a mandatory program, but we put in a series of soft opt-out and hard opt-out questions. So the soft opt-out questions are along the lines of, are you comfortable advocating for yourself? Are you comfortable communicating in English? Are you comfortable, and do you have access to a computer and the internet? So a series of questions where people can answer yes, no. The other party can't see the answers. We decided to not be too paternalistic and to decide for the person that if you answer yes, then you can't use it. because yeah. maybe they've figured out a workaround or they have somebody that can work with them. So we leave it to them to say, okay, you answered yes to this question. Do you still want to continue with ODR? And they can do that. But nonetheless, there's a series of opt-out opportunities depending on somebody's particular condition. And those, but it's up to them. So we call those soft opt-out questions. We also have hard opt-out questions where if you answer yes to these questions, you're not going to get on the platform. And is there a history of domestic violence? Is there a protection order here? Going back to one of the criticisms of the legal services organization about the imbalance, we ask whether you have an attorney. And at least at this early stage, we don't want either party having being represented by an attorney. And so that would kick you off the platform. Has to be under $10,000. There are a couple of jurisdictional requirements because it's really just New York County. So we did right at the front end build some procedural protections into even the small claims platform.
Mm-hmm. In the first tranche of questions, the soft opt-out, what's the level of human intervention? If somebody clicks the box that says okay, or signals in some way there may be an issue, is there a level of active human intervention at that point?
No, at that point, they're just answering the questions. It's up to them if they want to continue. Okay. So at that point, there is not.
Right. Okay. So we are dependent on someone comprehending the implications of the question, that once they've opted in, they've opted into a system. I suppose there must be other off-ramps at some point where they can choose to opt out.
You can always decide you're not going to go forward with the process.
Uh-huh.
It's that's not exclusive. It's not like one shot and you're done. You do have later opportunities also. Yeah. And to kind of leap ahead a little bit, it's kind of a tiered system.
Mm-hmm.
So we also, in the beginning, we created some videos, one about small claims, what are small claims, and another video about what is online dispute resolution. It was fun creating those videos. We selected animated characters, made them about a minute and a half long, very succinct. We got to do storyboards and all of that. So the process is actually kind of entertaining to be a little Hollywood producer and director. The idea is you have to listen to these videos first, watch them and listen to them. You have to go through the soft and hard opt-out questions. All your information, contact information has to be entered. The first stage is a blind bidding stage where somebody makes an offer and the other party responds. And the idea is that nobody knows exactly what the number is. It's blind, but mm-hmm. if there's a certain overlap, it's an automatic settlement. And they get three attempts at that. And again, that's all automated. If that happens, if they actually do fall within kind of the zone of agreement, this little overlap period where the settlement offer and the settlement demand overlap, then they are turned over to kind of a template exercise where, okay, you agreed on the amount, and now let's decide on some terms. And they walk through some checklist of terms. How are you going to pay? What form? Is it going to be credit card? Is it going to be check? Is it going to be money transfer? What are the dates? What's the minimum payment? So they kind of walk through that. Again, hopefully reach an agreement. So they do have some opportunities for direct communication when it gets to that point to see whether they can settle on the specific terms. If they can settle on the specific terms, it auto-populates into a settlement agreement that's modeled after the agreements that the court uses. So it's the same form as the court ordered, and it will go sent to the court, and the court has an opportunity to review it and approve it, but then it becomes a court order. And that's if everything kind of goes perfectly. So if it doesn't, and it's not always going to go perfectly. So if you can't agree on an amount, if you do agree on an amount, but you're struggling to agree on the terms, maybe the frequency of payments, you can request a mediator.
Okay.
So then we go to, there's two community mediator centers that New York court uses. So, and we had training periods with those community mediation centers to familiarize them with our online platform. And they have an opportunity to do that. And if it's successful, then the mediator will help them go through a mediated settlement agreement. And if it's not, then the beginning will go back to the court system. So,
And that if the mediator is called in, that also is online, I presume.
Yes.
Using technology such as we're using now.
Yeah, and it's all, so the platform we're using is the Court Innovations Matterhorn platform.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we did a lot of customization. And one of the problems is that we did so much. I mean, we put it in blind bidding, we put it in hard off, not soft, not that, with some very unique jurisdictional requirements because of the way that New York County is shaped. There are a lot of challenges in Matterhorn to customize continually. But when you're always customizing, you're gonna get glitches. And so we've had that happen to us, that the program progress, the flow, has been interrupted by different kinds of glitches. And we've got different stages. So as a party completes a stage, they really need notifications and kind of urging, encouragement. And we've had some problems getting out those notifications. But it's been a little bit of a challenge because we built such a comprehensive, detailed system that there's a lot of opportunities for things to go a little bit haywire.
Sure. But I take it from your conversation, this is up and running.
It's up and running.
Yeah.
We've had a few cases go through successfully.
Yeah.
We've had a number of them get partially through and different things stall them out. There are cases that are kind of still pending in mediation at different stages. So,
yeah.
But it seems that every month we are making improvements and getting closer to exactly what we hope we'd reach.
Yeah. One of the things that I discussed with Graham Ross and in fact earlier conversations in this series was what we mean by ODR. And one of the impressions, certainly through the pandemic, when everybody and their cousins suddenly found they had to move online and bought themselves a new microphone and fancy cameras and simply migrated their practices online. But clearly what you're doing and one of the things that Graham and others have emphasized is that it's more than simply migrating an in-person process to an online platform, because you've got quite a deal of technological facilitation going on, the automated processes. But it's also clear from what you say too, it's like the process is being devised for the UK courts. There's a tiered hierarchical process that it's automated, but there's a possibility of a next step intervention of human intervention. So there's at any stage, is there always going to be a possibility of human intervention? If somebody, let's say the early stages of filling out the forms, can't do it, is there a human being who can help them?
Yeah, that's another thing we had to kind of work out. The initial idea was that Matterhorn would provide a platform and that it was going to be pretty straightforward. And if there were any problems, you could issue tickets. The tickets aren't great because tickets involve a lot of delay. And when you have an ongoing dispute,
for sure,
that's probably one of the worst things. So one thing we've been working on in the past few months is figuring out a way to address questions as they come up during the process before we get to the request for mediation.
Right.
And when you've got an outside contractor, that involves fees.
And confidentiality.
Right. So, does it involve fees or not? It all depends on the nature of the question.
Yep.
If it's a question about maybe the failure of the technology, it doesn't seem that New York should be paying for that.
For sure.
But if it's just informational about the process and small claims and we've never really understood it, Matterhorn would say, well, we shouldn't be paying for that.
Yep.
There's a lot of back and forth on who would be responsible for answering those questions. But there is a recognition that you're going to get questions. You're going to get questions before you're done. And one way or another, you're going to have to provide some support. And so we're putting together some frequently asked questions, which are fine and they can be helpful. But I don't know if you ever use frequently asked questions to resolve your problems.
Yeah.
But what I
have don't.
It's never been that satisfied. But every once in a while, I'll see the question that I have. But often, they're not sufficiently well organized, they're hard to get through, and they aren't on point. That's so true. That's the cheap way to do it, but it isn't the most effective way. You really do need to be able to get to somebody relatively quickly.
Yeah. It seemed that you talked of sort of scaling back from the original project that you had in mind with New York to something that could be more manageable. And I'd love to be able to talk to Shannon Salter about what her experience was with the British Columbia, where they started with small claims, but have since scaled up to bigger exercises and no doubt dealing with the rule of law and more complicated issues. But you also mentioned one other thing too, when you mentioned the complexity of New York system and jurisdictional questions. In addition to that, are there or have there been cross-border, cross-state boundary jurisdictional questions of a claim that's arisen in a neighboring state or even across the states? Has that been an issue, or are you solely New York State?
Yeah, we're surely New York City, but it's technically New York County, which picks up a part of one of the boroughs outside of New York City.
Yeah.
So it's pretty limited geographically, although right now there is discussion about making it statewide, mm-hmm. which would be a significant expansion of the system from just the New York City area.
Yeah.
So we haven't done that yet.
I guess we have to start small on these things and get it right before we start taking on disputes between somebody in New York and somebody in Alaska.
Yes.
That may come hang about there. Intriguing stuff. And how long have you been up and running?
I guess it was maybe January 2021, okay. I think is when we started.
Yeah, so, and presumably there's an ongoing review process and refinement, of course.
The COVID pandemic really complicated things because we were in 2020 when the pandemic really hit us hard.
Yeah.
You know, the courts shut down. Staff was getting sick and offices were understaffed. Courts were processing cases. Cases were piling up. People were getting redirected. So for a period in 2020, from maybe mid-2020 going towards the end of the year, we couldn't do a lot with the ODR platform because people weren't available and there were other priorities in New York.
Sure.
But then it was decided that this has been kind of sitting too long and we got a big backlog and maybe the platform could help. So a little bit out of the blue, it was in late November, the order came out that it's going to go live in early January. So be ready. So suddenly it was, we had not really looked at it for about 3 months.
Yep.
And suddenly it was like, oh my God, we got just a few weeks. So we had to get things up and running very quickly, mm-hmm. in the as a result of the pandemic and the backlog and the new urgency. Get at least some cases moving forward.
Yeah, congratulations anyway to you and your team for doing that. And presumably we'll at some point see reviews. There'll be reports and reviews of that process and how it's worked out. David, can we move on, because I'm just aware there's just so much that you're doing. I'd love to capture a bit more of that as well. You've talked about working with an ODR task force. Who are they? What's the task force aimed at doing? What's your role in this?
Yeah, I'm probably one of the worst people in the world for monetizing what I do. So, although there was an honorarium for the beginning when I worked on the New York project, the last 4.5 years, it's mm-hmm. all been pro bono. Well, yeah. the task force, the ODR standards/guidance task force, also mm-hmm. is a pro bono project that took 3.5 years. So it's another long project. Another pro bono project. And we were pretty successful in getting people from around the world involved. Probably got 45 people from numerous different countries, a lot of names. Ian, you'll know people that are active in OCODR and the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution. A lot of familiar names, people that are well known in the ODR field. We formed 3 working groups to work on kind of general best practices, court ODR, and then private ODR. But the idea was things are moving quickly. People really could benefit from guidance in terms of what technology software should be using, how should they use it, what the confidentiality concerns are. There were just so many questions out there. The feeling was, we can be of assistance here by coming out with some guidance. And we collaborated with the National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution and the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution, talked about a lot of these issues. We still plan on doing something extremely detailed. NCTDR and ICODR have promulgated standards that are pretty general, but they're very helpful organizationally. We kind of follow that same organization. And the goal of the ABA project was maybe we can add some more details to that kind of the general categories that have been identified by those two other organizations. So that's what we tried to do, was to get more specific, provide more specific examples. But having said that, there's a lot more that we could do, and hopefully we can do together with those two other organizations.
Well, I'm again happy to be talking to you about that, because as a new member of the board of the ICODR, and now having joined the subgroup on standards, it's a conversation we should continue, because clearly we're not working against each other. I mean, to the extent that you talked about looking at the standards of NCTDR and ICODA, and I like the idea that you mentioned there of moving from a level of generality of general principles, which ICODA certainly has, to specificity in particular cases. That's an ongoing project, isn't it? All those standards and ethics are a constant process of refinement. So is there somewhere, is there a platform or a website we can go to have a look at your ODR Task Force website?
Yeah, links? They are. They were kind of publicized a few months ago. They are on the American Bar Association website, section of dispute resolution.
Okay.
So the guidelines are available there. I have them posted on my LinkedIn page.
Yeah.
David Allen Larson, if everybody's interested in looking at my LinkedIn page, they're accessible there. So there are other places. Alan Wiener, Amy Schmitz, and myself were the principal drafters, in the sense that, so we worked with all these different people, all these working groups. Somebody had to collect all the feedback and information, put together into a document. So we were the three people that did that. We have submitted an article to the Ohio State Journal on Dispute Resolution that talks a little bit about the process, and also will provide the guidance and in its full form. So it also will be available then as part of a law review article from the Ohio State Journal on Dispute Resolution, which will then be available on Lexis and Westlaw and software platforms. And that should be moving forward quite quickly.
Okay, excellent. I'll keep an eye out for that. And again, in my newly minted role on ICODA, I'll be very interested to keep in conversation with you. And I, as you may be aware, I spoke with Amy on this podcast series a couple of months ago. So she's a well-known character in our respective worlds.
Yeah, she's extremely productive. One thing I'll mention is that, you know, there's a long running debate on whether or not you should do guidance or standards.
Yep.
The feeling is, if you don't do standards, they're not going to have any teeth. Nobody's going to follow them. You know, what's their value? But then the concern is that, well, if you're going to do standards, who's going to oversee them? Who's going to enforce them? Who's going to implement them? Who's going to update them? So there's that side of it. And the other side is, well, then maybe we should just do guidance. And maybe the field isn't fully developed enough to be creating standards, because things are still changing so quickly that whatever standards you create are going to be out of date relatively quickly. So don't try and make standards, because those are a little too rigid and inflexible. And do guidance. And so, understanding those concerns, we started by doing a standard project. We kind of evolved over to doing guidance.
Interesting. I mean, this has given me a certain deja vu sense, because I recall being involved over 30 years ago in that same question in relation to mediation. Online hadn't been heard of, really, or was just very nascent, but with a body called NADREC, the National Australian Dispute Resolution Council, or might have been an alternative in there somewhere, with the same question as to whether, because mediation was at a very early stage, whether we could have standards or guidance. And in business ethics, the same question as to whether you have standards or self-regulation. It's an ongoing question, and it's an ongoing conversation, I guess, we need to have. But what we can do, or people who listen to this can certainly go to that website, and what I make, and certainly to your LinkedIn page. So we'll certainly pursue that. A couple more things I'd like to pick up, because I'm aware of you're a busy man, and we would like to pick up a couple more things. Going back to one of the things that we started with, your concern with access to justice and the question of access generally, is access to justice and access to technology, which has been two parallel questions in many of my conversations. One of your concerns, one of your key professional roles, has been with disability access. Could you say a bit more about your work and how that's meshed with the ODR and technology field?
Yeah, so going back in time, from 1990 to 91, I had a managerial appointment with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. Uh-huh. And although I was part of the appellate division, I also got the assignment because I had done some work on the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. We didn't have an ADA yet. It didn't come into effect until 1991, wasn't passed until 1990. When I got my appointment, it had not yet been made its way through Congress. And I got the assignment to work with the Office of Legal Counsel, which is the kind of the legislative regulatory arm of EEOC. They draft material like guidance, compliance manual, and things like that. But then it goes over to the Office of General Counsel, of which I was part, which are the litigators, the idea being that, well, people that are doing litigation may see something different than the policymakers. So I got that assignment on the behalf of the Office of General Counsel to review all the tremendous labor that the Office of Legal Counsel had done to put together the regulations and interpretive guidance for the Americans with Disabilities Act. So you have the act itself, and then you get much more detail in regulations and interpretive guidance. So I had done some scholarship in the area, and then I really dove into it with that assignment at EOC to review the regulations and interpretive guidance. And I always felt that, so these people had their kind of lifelong commitment to working on this project. And yeah. I come in on a rather temporary appointment, and yet they still have to go through me. I thought that was a little frustrating to them. But yeah. But it was really productive. I was able to make some suggestions that actually made it in. Mm. to those regulations and interpretive guidance. But that got me started working more intensely in that area, and I've continued to do that over time. And then we got to, you know, the growth of online dispute resolution, and it became clear that there's a whole new world being created, and there's a tremendous danger that there is a population, more than one population, that may be excluded from this world, and that we need to make sure that people aren't being left behind. And persons with disabilities can be left behind because there could be a lot about online behavior that is not accessible, that you have to be sighted, you have to be able to hear, you have to have certain mobility, you have to be able to click relatively quickly, or the opportunity to click will go away. Mm-hmm. Not only do you need visual acuity, you might be able to, maybe you have to have certain color ability, that there's contrast and colors that don't work for you, and you won't be able to see on the screen. If you use a screen reader, it becomes critical how your screens are laid out for a screen reader to work and to work efficiently. So we need to pay a lot of attention to what's being done online, because we are going back ever again to a world where all of our conduct is face-to-face. That's never going to happen again. Yeah. And we want to bring everyone along with us.
Mm-hmm. It's such important work. Just thinking of just even just one of the elements that you mentioned. Here we are looking at each other in wonderful, glorious color. But if you think of a screen with TypeScript on it, for someone who has one of a range of color blindness, that isn't necessarily going to make much sense to them, or is told to click here on the red button on the screen. You know, if I think, you might say my late father was green red colorblind, and he could only work out traffic signals by knowing which light was lit up. You know, he could that way tell what was red or green. But I mean, it's stuff that many people will simply not have cognizance of. In terms, they'll think of access in terms of the affordability of technology, or does the broadband Wi-Fi extend to your part, remote part of the country? But even when you're there, there are issues of access, and the work you're doing is desperately important. So thank you for doing that.
There are some legal requirements too. We do have the Americans with Disabilities Act, and when I was at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they do employment. That's Title I. We have Titles II and III. Titles II deal with government agencies and how their behavior has to be accessible and their operations. Then we have Title III, which is a huge title that deals with public accommodations with businesses. And there's been litigation with Title III, but there's been, again, some confusion over to what degree does this statute that was written for a face-to-face, real, concrete, physical world apply in this virtual world. There's been confusion about that. And it's pretty well settled in the United States, although I don't think it ever should have been a question, that if you have a physical location and you decide to expand your reach by creating a website, that website will be under the Title III requirements of reasonable accommodation, that you're going to have to do things with your website to make them accessible. There's been confusion, however, about whether or not if you don't have a physical location, but if you just operate online, does this statute that was written for a physical world still apply to you? You never existed in the physical world. Your business was always online. I think the better rule, and some courts have recognized this, is that it doesn't make any difference. You still fit the definition of a business, and the ADA should apply to you, but that hasn't been completely settled, unfortunately.
Intuitively, it would seem that's the obvious answer, but you can think of even pre-pandemic how many businesses were set up wholly online, just small sellers, traders operating out of a storage locker or even their living room, have never had a bricks presence. It's only clicks. You're dealing with some pretty large items here, Dave, aren't you? And I don't know how you have time to look quite so relaxed as you do, as well as getting the other stuff in your no doubt important academic life. Dave, can I on that point wrap up this conversation or move towards doing so with one question? Clearly, a number of the courses you're involved with involve ODR online aspects of legal teaching. How's this been received by your student population?
I think my students are really excited about technology and online. I'm still teaching my courses online synchronously. So I'm not going in, we're not teaching face-to-face. And I'm teaching some courses that are getting into some delicate issues. When you talk about race discrimination, you talk about religious discrimination, disability discrimination, those can be difficult conversations. You talk about things like affirmative action. Is that desirable? My experience has been that, fortunately, those classes tend to be 30 students or less. They all fit pretty nicely on a screen. Mm-hmm. You can see everybody's faces. I require people to keep their cameras on. I have much better conversations in the virtual environment where we can see each other, faces, reactions, hear our tone. We can do it from an environment in which we're comfortable. We don't have to travel to somebody's office as you would to do, for example, a traditional mediation. Sure. You don't necessarily have to do it, although we have set times. We do other things that are asynchronous that you can do at your convenience. So at least my experience with technology and teaching has been a good one. I also teach torts, and torts tends to be the bigger class where you can have up to 100. I haven't had 100 yet, but you have more people that fit on one screen. And then you're dealing with multiple screens and it's a little harder to do.
Yep.
And it's a large class, but the smaller classes on one screen, I think they work well. As a general matter, students who are integrating more and more technology into their daily lives continually, mm-hmm. like the idea of using it professionally also. So I started saying, when I started doing this, the turn of the century, you know, I said there's going to be this huge generational shift that I think most people recognize now, that we have digital immigrants and digital natives.
Sure.
There are people that are growing up with so much technology that the idea of doing something face-to-face and traveling somewhere and scheduling it and making all the adjustments is just ridiculous. They're not going to do it.
Yeah. The teaching that you currently do, did you take up that sort of really full-time online teaching through the pandemic, or were you doing that before the pandemic?
So Mitchell Hamlin School of Law is a combination of Hamlin University School of Law and William Mitchell College of Law.
True.
William Mitchell College of Law has been around for a long time, turning into the 20th century, right around 1905, I think they started. And they got the first approval from the American Bar Association, I think it's either 7 or 8 years ago before our merger, to be able to start delivering courses online, which the ABA wasn't letting anybody do. Mm-hmm. So we started delivery of online courses earlier than anybody else, well before the pandemic.
Right.
And the opportunity to teach online was available before the pandemic. And I had done that. At that point, they were just being presented asynchronously, which I don't enjoy as much as the synchronous courses online.
Nah. Mm-hmm.
So I did do it asynchronously. I didn't love it personally, but I am really enjoying the synchronous online courses.
Cool.
And that really became available, and I teach all my courses that way. That wasn't possible pre-pandemic. I don't know if they would have let me do that. But even though now that we're kind of edging our way out of the pandemic, mm-hmm. although some people I think are edging out only because they can't wait anymore, they're impatient, not because it's over.
Yeah.
But even though we're edging our way out, they're still letting me teach online, which I appreciate.
Yep. Do you imagine there'll be an expectation that you move back into in-person teaching?
I would guess at some point they may want me to, but we are getting feedback from not an insignificant population of students that say, we really like this. This is better for us. It's better for our lives. We have a lot of students these days who are not straight out of college. They have some other commitments. They have familial commitments. They have kids. They have spouses. They may have caretaking responsibilities for their family members. Maybe they're still working. And they just cannot fit on a face-to-face schedule.
Sure.
Several times a week.
It's a tricky one, that, isn't it? Because I remember just a few weeks ago, not long after we moved to Wellington, I went to meet a former colleague from my next university here, Victoria University of Wellington, who was actually quite disheartened because of the pandemic, the classes had moved online and they were morphing to a partly online, partly in person. The teachers, the fellow professors, were delivering their classes in person, but recording them. So you could watch synchronously, but most of the students, more than half the students, were electing to watch those lectures in their own time, asynchronously. And I walked around the campus of the law school campus and it was desolate. There was just nobody there. And it's not the campus that I recall when I left there in mid-2008. It was lifeless. And it's not the same experience. I mean, it sounds as though you've made a very positive experience, both before the pandemic and of necessity during the pandemic. But there is that human element that's also important to, in terms of a presence I would have no doubt that students would actually benefit from being in your presence rather than simply being at the other end of a screen with you. But it's a world we're still shaping, isn't it, David?
And when you are in a physical place, you have the opportunity for this spontaneous occurrences where you just run into somebody that you didn't anticipate. And we have not yet created that kind of space online where that happens spontaneously. So as you observed, in terms of community building, it is harder to do when you're doing all your classes online because you're not meeting up afterwards in the hallway. You're just not having these serendipitous run-ins where you maybe make connections that you never thought you would make. Mm-hmm. That's something we need to continue to think about. Can we create a space where that can happen online? I think we can, and we just haven't done it.
That's where Colin, with whom I spoke, and I think in the third of these podcasts, would get terribly excited and say, this is what the metaverse is about, where you can create your avatars. I'm not yet convinced. But David, I mentioned at the outset how much of your time I appreciate and would not want to take any more. So I think we should wrap up. I mean, there's just so much more in each of the things that you discussed. I would like to take further, and there's always an opportunity in these loosely scheduled podcasts to come back and have a second bite at the cake, if I may. But David, thank you so much for your time, and because I know scheduling this has been quite tricky given how busy you are, but I value your time and hugely value your contribution to the ODR field. So thank you so much for your time.
That's very kind of you, but I enjoyed and I really appreciate the invitation.
This podcast has been brought to you by ICODER, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about ICODER or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.